start with, when I was younger, I think I was 14 or 15, I was diagnosed with depression. I forgot what if it was listed as major or minor, it doesn't matter, but I remember being quite sad as an adolescent and not knowing why. And also, I was diagnosed with obsessive-compulsive disorder, actually. And this is actually something I don't share a lot, but I think that at the time, I thought, like, maybe something was wrong with me, and I was seeing, you know, a host of therapists and psychiatrists, and nothing was working. I just found myself to get very frustrated if I wasn't able to control or, you know, really organize a lot of things in my life. And so when things were disorganized or if I wasn't, you know, now what I recognize is like me not being accepted by my surroundings or feeling accepted, it would launch into some sort of panic where I would try to fix it by being clean enough, religious enough, you know, funny enough to my peers at school. And so that was kind of like the hurting that was going on. And it was very exhausting at the time. And I think that I was trying to do a lot of different things to find respite or relief. I think different friendships, finding validation in my parents, you know, not recognizing when they did give me validation and so fighting for it again. There's a lot of things. But I want to talk about, like, I wanted to start there because that's where my heart went. And it's leading me to think about how it got there, what I know now about how it got there. So there's a couple things, and what I want to start with is that, well, there was a big shift in my life between middle school and high school. And I think that's true for a lot of folks. You know, in high school, I went to a 2000 plus high school. Our graduating class was like 500 people, and it was in Novi High School, where you know, Oakland County at the time was one of the richest counties in the United States. So what that means is that there's a lot of white folks, and that there's a lot of wealth. And my first year in high school was 2001. My first week in high school was when September 11th happened. And so as a visibly brown person, I felt like I had to survive. Now, at the time, I didn't know that I was doing that. But when you're in a social environment and you have to find your footing to just keep going, you might end up having notions of, okay, don't be weak. Society sucks. This is on you. You have to work harder. And it's a peculiar thing when not all the adults are in tune with prejudice either. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was younger, like a little kid, I had assumed that, oh, well, adults are, you know, they always got their heads on right, and, you know, they'll help you, and they're supposed to help you. I mean, that's who's taking care of you during the daytime. It's not your parents, it's them. But in high school, I kind of got a wake-up call that, you know, I knew which teachers weren't going to allow prejudice towards me happen in front of them, but I could count them on one hand. So that's really, I think that's one thing that contributed to it. The other thing that contributed to it, as I look back, you know, a lot of times we think that it's like these traumatic stressors and, you know, bullying or like, you know, these tensions that I'm speaking about, like, you know, the part where I'm in high school and I'm a minority and I'm finding my footing and it's hard. It is those things that create these ways of thinking and ways of surviving. But sometimes it's also natural life junctures that occur that are compounded with that at the same time. So, for example, my father was sick my entire adolescence. In the late 90s, he had triple bypass heart surgery, and he recovered. He had surgery, and it was successful. And then right after that, he had lymphoma, cancer, and he had chemotherapy, and he recovered, and he worked during his chemotherapy too. And so that message of you keep going was there. My siblings are much older than me. One is 10 years older than me. My sister, one is 13 years older than me. So by the time that I was in adolescence, one was married, and the other one was, I think he was in his residency. I don't know what he was doing. I think he was in medical school. They were gone. So it was me, my mom, and my dad in the house. And so strongly, the messages in my heart were about how do you take care? How do you not bother? How do you support what's going on in the house? Mm-hmm. So that's why I say now, it doesn't always have, a lot of our, I won't call them, well, they are distortions, but I think a better way to say it is a lot of the coping mechanisms we use to survive that aren't quite always based in the full truth don't always come from trauma. Sometimes they come from circumstances at the same time. And you need support during those times. And so if you're not getting support and you don't have the right peer and adult support during that time, you can start forming some ways of being. And I think a lot of that stuff, right, like high school and also what's going on in my home contributed to I have to just duck my head, be perfect, and if I don't, it's on me. I have done something shameful. And so OCD, now I know that there's a lot of that that contributes to it. And I'm also a mental health professional, so I've, sat in the room with a lot of people who have different manifestations of obsession and compulsion. And now I can humanize it. It's not just, oh, there's something wrong in your brain. It's also what happened in your life that required you to put it on yourself to be perfect. Mm-hmm. And where was that not sustainable? Where now it's a healthy endeavor to think about your relief. We really, as a society, I think, we look at things and we look at the physiological aspect of them. Yes, of course, a panicked brain works differently than an unpanicked brain. Like, it's not a discovery. It's just what it is. An elevated, physiology is different than one that's not. And that's a really important and useful resource to know that. And another important resource is, okay, how does it get there? Over the past 5 or 6 years of my life, actually, I would say a little bit longer, I think in college, 2008 to now, I've been really working on reclaiming that and knowing, like, okay, what was going on with Zane during those years? What did he really need? And I think really I needed more support, and I needed more permission that it's okay to just have a respite and not be in charge of everything that's happening, that my dad being sick was out of my control, that the prejudice in school was out of my control. So, yeah, I mean, those were the stressors. And I would combat them by, like, again, needing to be clean, needing to be the most religious, or needing to, like, have, the best grades. And if I didn't, it's so fragile. It's like you get the grade right underneath the one that you wanted, and it's like, well, you screwed everything up. And I think society does not buffer you from those things, unless you have very novel support systems, because we have all these really weird notions about what it means to be valid. It was tough. It was really tough.
I can hear that. I can see that. I can imagine. You talk mm-hmm. about, from 2008 and forward, working on reclaiming. What's the, from these experiences that you had, and as you started working on reclaiming and healing, what did you do? How did you start doing that work?
Well, if it's okay, I'd like to start a little bit before about how I attempted to do that work.
Sure.
2008 is a marker because, well, I'll put it to you this way. So, like, I'm a person with a lot of nerdy analogies, so I hope you don't mind. So babies, when they're born, they know how to do, like, a full body breath, right? Like, they, because, like, you know, that's they're living and, you know, they're doing like the healthy things naturally, right? You know, growth has a lot to do with that. Adults, like, we're really like in our head, and sometimes we like shorten our breaths and we're not really breathing fully. We don't know. 2008 is a marker because I had put enough things, enough resources, enough good friends, and I went to therapy, and I was doing things that were meaningful to me, and I was doing something in school meaningful to me. I had really had my first real, like breath, like I felt it, like I felt joy, and it's not something you feel every day. Like happiness is not like this, oh, you're just smiling 100% of the time every day. I think it's more about like self-trust and being able to navigate things, including challenges that come up. But 2008 is the first time that I really thought, like, I'll put it this way, really witnessed myself having the ability to do that. And by contrast, that's the only thing that sort of clued me into, oh, I didn't believe in that I could have this before. in high school, in the latter years, right, my junior and my senior year, there were some methods of coping that weren't quite appropriate or healthy, but at the time, it's what allowed me to navigate the social space. And so what I did a lot with my peers is that I would become some sort of mascot for them. So like, for example, if I could do like an Indian voice for my friends, then they would be entertained. And now, okay, like this is like, cool, I have friends. It's, and it was like, it was enjoyable, but it was also like, as I look back, like, why couldn't I just be myself without having some sort of like niche or like turn my culture into a, you know, an entertainment, you know, step stool for them? Like it was that, I look back and it's easy to be ashamed of that. But I think it's important to be compassionate towards myself too about what I was doing. But I just think like, shoot, like I shouldn't have had to do that. You know, and we do that. Like we internalize like the structures around us, mm-hmm. and we say, okay, we need to find our footing. And you know, I remember that I needed to shame my own culture, make it some sort of a spectacle, and then people would not bother me then. And if I additionally had a niche, if I was good at something, then people would praise me for that thing. So for me, it was humor, and I'll get to the second thing. But if it's, you know, humor, then it's fine. Again, and I didn't know I was doing it. But now I look back and I'm like, wait, everyone in front of me was a white person, and I'm sitting here putting out a show about their prejudice, about my culture. That's what was happening. And yeah, so it was a very interesting time, and nobody now has diversity. However, it's a wealthy place, and so there's a lot of tokenizing. So a lot of South Asian people that were there at the time, you know, it wasn't just white, but a lot of South Asian people that were there at the time, it was sort of like this battle for how do you just appease the white power structure and survive here and be excellent and don't, you have to get good grades and, you know, it wasn't like, you don't bother it, right? So it wasn't a lot of critical thinking, let me put it that way. Okay. It wasn't like a culture-centric, like a multicultural-centric, like, experience at all. And just by virtue of having people of different races, I mean, you know, the black kids are used for sports, the brown kids are used for, you know, whatever. And, like, it's not, like, fully embracing, like, I am who I am, and that's awesome experience. It's not, because they're still, like, you're still in a really, like, wealthy area in school where, like, whiteness is the standard. And, like, you know, schmoozing with the coaches and you know, those kind of things is the standard. Like, and so I struggle with that. The other way that I coped before 2008 was that I started writing when I was in high school in about 2003, 2004. I started making music. I've always had rhythm because when I'm Punjabi, And so Punjabis have rhythm. it's sort of immersed in our culture. Out of all the world's, you know, diaspora cultures, I think being Punjabi, it's just one of the things that's part of being Punjabi. There's rhythm when we talk. There's rhythm in our language. There's rhythm in our music. That's one. The other is that when I was 4 years old, my brother is a lot older than me, I said earlier, and he was, like, really into, like, Public Enemy in the early 90s. So, like, I'd be a four-year-old waking up to, like, Public Enemy or, you know, like, Eric B. and Rakim or the Beastie Boys or Run DMC and all this kind of stuff. So you get that stuff at an early age into your ears. It becomes language.
Yeah.
So in high school, I really embraced, like, what can I do with that rhythm? And I started writing poetry, started writing hip-hop, I started producing music. I still do it today. At that time, it was my first catharsis. It was my first therapy. If I could write something on a page and then perform it, it was like, oh, man, like, I enjoyed that, too. The part that I didn't like is that it was like doing that for other people at that time was like a neighboring experience to them being entertained by the other things I was doing for my humor. So they were like, oh, well, he's cool because he's that rapper kid, right? Which is really condescending because I'm like, what if I wasn't? Would you notice me? Like, and I recently went to my high school reunion, and, you know, they have good intentions, and that's what they knew about me in high school. But it's been 10 years, and the first question is like, yo, you still rapping, bro? Like, that's, and it's like, wait, hold on, like, ask me what I'm doing these days or something like that. And that's the part that bothered me, is that even the things that I did for my own catharsis were reframed as, like, this caricature, you know, to, like, for people. And that's why I said that I began finding ways, but it wasn't, like, this full experience of relief that I was seeking. It wasn't close. So in spurts writing, and I have some poems that I still recite from that time that do give me a lot of relief, but it wasn't the Renaissance period for Zane, I'll put it that way, you know? And so, but in 2008, I'll get to that. I'm sorry, I know this was a little bit long-winded. but in 2008, I had, like, you know, really had some bouts with the depression and OCD my freshman and sophomore year of college. I felt alone. You know, you make another transition from high school to college. You start recognizing that the friendships you had in high school were limited and how safe they felt, and you're searching. So to have that experience and then to search and then to have these extreme bouts with, like, 3 or 4 hour-long showers to be clean, right, or to pray and re-pray, I was not doing so well my freshman and sophomore year. And it you know, sort of transformed into, like, me not, I didn't go to class. I failed a class. I failed a basic level class that, you know, I should have done well in, and then I was definitely afraid of, like, making my dad, my sick dad, like, you know, mad and giving him another additional stress. Like, all these things were going on, and there's a constant battle in my head about, like, all of this going, it's like spreading your mess, spreading your filth. That's what it felt like. And I know that's not true now, but that's what it felt like, and that's what I was beating myself up about. When I was a junior, after failing a class, there's this interesting thing that happens when you tell yourself, well, I ain't got nothing to lose now, and it can go in two directions. You can say, well, I stink, I suck, and I might as well do whatever. But that's not so true. And it's a distortion. So I had enough things, and I remember my sister's voice being like, see what you want and see if you like it. And I remember just thinking about my music and other things. And so I just, like, took a shot in the dark and took a bunch of classes I really liked and didn't know what I was going to graduate with or whatever, but I just took some film classes and some music classes and some theater classes and oh my gosh, like, and then I started going to therapy, and I got back into slam poetry, and I, for the first time, I think, like, I was kind of doing it all for me.
Right, coming from the inside.
Yeah, and that's why that 2008 thing was a marker. And then, you know what, it felt so good I didn't stop. I still battle, you know, it's not like 2008 to now, 2016 is like just this time where there haven't been any challenges. There's been some immense up and downs. My father passed in 2011, actually, when he wasn't sick. He passed. He died from, he started coughing at night, and then he, you know, he had septic shock, so his organs failed, and then he passed away the next day in 2011. But he wasn't like diagnosed with an illness. Like, he didn't have cancer or heart problem. Like, in 2006, he also had pneumonia and a weak immune system is bad. So he didn't have any of that. He literally got my oil changed for me the night before he passed.
Oh man.
So that was an interesting thing, but. Yeah, no, it's those type of moments over the past 8 years have always challenged me again and tested me again and brought back like old notions, because it's a momentous thing when something like that happens, and so you wrestle with yourself when things like that happen, and everybody grieves differently, and so I'm going to grieve the way Zane's going to based on what kind of life Zane has had, right? And so, but yes, 2008, a lot of great things were going on, and I don't know, that's also the year that we started at Michigan State, the MSU Slam Poetry Team, and I was one of the founders, and we also started the Tunnel of Oppression, which was sort of modeled after Loyola Chicago's Tunnel of Oppression. Basically, it's like the Vagina Monologues. It's about reclaiming stories based on the social location. And so we would address a lot of different things. We would address abuse at like the university level, a domestic level, an international level. So things like racism on campus, tuition problems, sex trafficking, mental health shaming, a lot of different things. And we would collect stories from students around the MSU community, and then we would sort of audition in the spring semester, and then we would cast, and we would do the shows, and the stage was set up kind of like a tunnel or a haunted house, and people would walk through and have this like very evoking experience, and then afterwards we would process, and the counseling center from Michigan State would be involved to help people process, and it was really rewarding doing that. And I think I did that for 7 years. I did a Tunnel of Oppression for 7 years.
Wow.
I carried it. I directed it while I was doing my master's, and then while I was doing my PhD coursework as well.
Did you help to start that? So you started the team, and you also started the Tunnel of Oppression program?
Yeah, well, the slam poetry team, well, there was four of us that started it. Me, Will Langford, Megan Snavely, and Jimmy Choi. William Langford is somebody who's very active in the Detroit community and the public schools and storytelling and art there. Megan Snavely, she has her YouTube channel, and James I haven't talked to in a while, but it was a great team, and we did it together. But of course there was a lot of myself in there, I'll say that purposefully. And they would probably say the same. And for the tunnel, yeah, we started it together. The person whose idea it was, her name is Lori, Harlori Toki, but we founded it together. She had presented the idea. Is it okay if I talk to you about the way it came about?
Oh, sure. This is your story. I want to hear as much as you
want to tell. Okay. If I'm doing that thing again where it's like, am I talking too much? When somebody's asking me to talk. But anyways. Yeah, my friend once said to me, he's like, Zane, you don't talk a lot, you say a lot, there's a difference. And I was like, that's a beautiful reframe. But anyways, so, and actually I was reminded of this yesterday because the dude was in the news. There's there's this group on campus at Michigan State that was around 2005, 2006, 2007, called Young Americans for Freedom, and they're always labeled something like that. For Freedom, they're always labeled something like that. But it was basically a white supremacist group that was on campus, and they had events like Catch an Immigrant Day, where they would dress somebody up in blackface and chase them around campus.
Oh, shit.
They would have Quran desecration competitions. Whoever desecrated the Quran in the most creative way would win a prize or something like that. And they would invite speakers who would say a lot of sometimes coded but sometimes blunt racist things about Mexican folks, and you know, it was like a whole thing. And I remember one time they even I'm pretty sure that, yeah, they were involved. They started distributing a video that Fox came out with called Obsession, which is basically the message in the movie is, watch out for your Muslim neighbor. He might be a terrorist. Like, it was like really like loaded stuff. So the problem with them is that Michigan State University allowed them to function as a student organization. And Southern Poverty Law Center had named them a hate group. And it was very peculiar. It was a very peculiar thing because most of the students in that organization, when we saw them, like, because they would come, like, they would come and always be in people's way when there were, like, other cultural things happening on campus. They'd just show up and sort of posture and just kind of plant, you know what I mean? And then, like, it was interesting because I think the faculty advisor was a black man, and there was a one student, she was South Asian, and I was like very confused at the time about all of that, but I remember it was, people just didn't feel safe on campus emotionally, and so what happened was, during that time, there was sort of a coalition of students, students for Economic Justice, the Jewish Student Organization, the Muslim Student Association, which I was also a part of. And by the way, this is new for me. Being part of stuff, that was new for me. You know, the Coalition of Indian Undergraduate Students, the Women's Resource Center, Women's Studies, like all these things, all these organizations sort of created a coalition called the Peace Over Prejudice Campaign, and one of the initiatives that came out of it was the Tunnel of Oppression.
Okay.
And Young Americans for Freedom sort of withered away, and so did Peace Over Prejudice, because those things, you know, when they have certain leaders and those leaders graduate, tend to, like, reform into new things and new names later. But the tunnel stayed because it was, like, a literal event.
Okay.
The first year, Lori and the whole team did it, but the 6 years that followed that, I was not the sole director, but I was basically I directed the shows. Like, you know, I was in charge of making sure Tunnel happened. And some odd years I'd have like a co-director, but not in a, it would always be supportive, but it wouldn't be, I had to make sure Tunnel kept going, I'll say it that way.
Sure.
So I did that until 2014.
Okay, that sounds amazing. Did you record the performances? I mean, are they available somewhere to check out?
There's one year that we did a recording, but there's like a limited number of DVDs that we have. I think I might have one somewhere. There's a lot of pictures. There's a Facebook page for it too, for whoever's directing it now, at Michigan State.
What I can do is I'll look that up and I'll just put a link to the Facebook page.
Yeah, you can look it up. Yeah, and there's a lot of articles written about Tunnel at Michigan State as well. But yeah, and that was a really cathartic thing. I felt like I was doing something for the campus community. Like, what does it mean to have like really weak recourse at a campus when there's elevated sexual assault? But you know what? Somebody in the tunnel can say, "Well, this is happening, and I don't have to," and I'm going to validate myself about it. It's a very powerful, unapologetic experience about, you know, you recognize your own pain. And that was pretty awesome to be part of that. And I met so many different people, And I learned to, like, back away and center somebody else's story. That's the only way you can do that work, in a non-patronizing way.
Sure. Sounds very powerful.
It was. And you know, in the theater space, it's sort of a neighbor to, like, things like Regina Monologues, because it's taking something personal and it's reclaiming it and saying, like, that's my story and here's how I'm affected, rather than, you know, talking heads speaking for it from a distance.
Okay. No, I'm glad you shared that. Thank you.
Yeah.
So then, let's step forward. Yeah, keep going.
Oh, you want me to tell you? Okay, I can tell you about, you want me to tell you about that span, 2008 and 2016
or so? Sure. You know, so the things that you're doing to, you know, to heal yourself are really powerful. And to the extent that you involve other people and you help other people heal, you know, it's even more powerful. And to the extent that other people can learn from it and watch it and learn from the things that you're doing, that's what the Rising Phoenix is all about. So if there's some other things you want to share, you know, things that you've been working on, things that you've shared, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, earlier I had said that, like, in my youth I was definitely afraid of, like, spreading my filth or spreading my sin, and, like, in the sense of, like, well, I've screwed everything up, you know.
Right.
And I now, as I look back, I think that my heart really wanted to spread the other part, which is the relief part. And that's why it couldn't just stop as me writing a poem. I needed to, like, do tunnel. I needed it, you know. Because you take something and it's a seed, you want to see that seed grow. And you feel like that's real, like that's what I've been wanting to look at my whole life. So it wasn't enough to just kind of see myself. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like, you know, we could frame that, like we did earlier, as, like, you know, we're being there for other people. Honestly, like, that was a huge part of it, and that's what my heart was saying at the time. But now that I look back, now that we're sitting here and talking, I really needed that. Like, I needed to spread it. I needed to spread this, like, it's okay to find relief, and you can do it by expressing this or that or whatever. And one of the ways that I did that is that I started taking some human development classes, and, you know, I went after becoming a therapist. And another way that I did that was I sort of reclaimed my art, and I would continue producing and making music. It was sort of a nerdy and private endeavor. I wouldn't always show, not in a public way. I'd show my friends all the time, but I wouldn't always, like, finish a song and put it online. And I'm not very good at that sort of thing, like online marketing or whatever. And then also, I kept going to therapy, and I had a therapist that was an experiential therapist. So for him, it wasn't enough for us to just talk and conceptualize, like, what it means to feel better. He wanted me to let myself experience it in the room as a testament to myself. Once we had a good relationship, of course, but, like, so we would, like, for example, we do, like, something called an empty chair, which I use in my own work too. It just means that, like, you confront the thing that has been in the way, right in front of you, and you talk to it. And you can't do that with every client. It's got to fit, but I was a theatrical person. I'm a slam poet, so I loved it. It was the best, because all my therapists before that, I gotta be honest, they didn't move me. And it's not a slight on them. It wasn't a good fit. Except for there was one, and that was not a good fit, and it was directly because of how they were treating me. And I remember being 15, and this psychiatrist at U of M thought that my OCD was about me being inhibited sexually.
Okay.
So she brought my parents in the room, and imagine, this white lady, and three of us are South Asian, and I'm always afraid of bothering my dad. And so so this lady goes, well, he needs to be having more sex.
Oh, man.
And I was 15, and like, at the time I was like, what the hell? And, like, now I look back and I'm like, wow, how orientalist and xenophobic is that?
Yeah,
that was pretty jacked up. She didn't know what she was doing, man. And it was hurting. It was hurtful. But so to have a good therapist, you need to try therapy again for that. That's pretty awesome. And I started seeing him in 2007, 2008. And I'm not surprised that all those things were located at the same time, right? So,
yeah. You know, that's a good thing. That is an amazing thing. The fact, you know, some people may be trying to help. They may have good intentions, but sometimes they don't have the tools or the knowledge or the understanding of how they can really help somebody. If you don't mind, I'd like to ask a question. You know, Sarah had mentioned that you're the creative director of the Muslim Mental Health Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that clearly puts you in a position where you're going to help other people, and you know, people are going to be dealing with some of the same things we're talking about. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. The Institute of Muslim Mental Health was born while I was actually in college. So there's two parts to it. There's a Journal of Muslim Mental Health, mm-hmm. which I was sort of like an undergraduate, and I would like find those articles to like cite for a paper in a class. Like I had no connection to it. But it was awesome to see Muslims talking about mental health. Anytime you see a community that's, you know, insular for their own protection, it's, you know, and there's a lot of stigmas, you are always like relieved when somebody's doing that work, right? And so it was cool. And but I had nothing to do with it. I was a student. I was young. And the other part of the institute is the conference. They do a conference every year. So in 2008, in 2009, one of my friends, his name is Halim, he was starting to get his master's and his PhD in psychology. And he's a black man. He's Muslim. And he's from the Southeast Michigan area. And we knew each other through different, like, sort of like, I guess, like mosque and religious organizing, like when we were younger. And he's like probably 4 or 5 years my senior. So he like invited me one day, I think while I was getting my master's, it was 2009 or 2010, he invited me to like come out to Ann Arbor to meet with this man, Hamada Hamid, who I didn't know at the time, started a journal. And then they sort of invited me to be part of this process because I think that they had seen some of the other things that I was doing and the fact that I was, you know, getting my master's and I wanted to, and they were just like, we need a youth presence here, and they chose me, and I was like, whoa, what? I'm at the center of this all of a sudden? Like, I was just taking like 5 showers the other day because I didn't know how to cope, and now I'm at the center of this? Like, it was weird, but I accepted it, and you know, I played my role. And the institute really is that. It's the journal and the conference. And Michigan State is a sponsor of the conference now. And so, like, it, even though it's a national thing, the players that were in it like happened to be at the university I was going to school at. So it all kind of just worked out. The person who runs the journal is at Hartford Seminary in, I think, what is it, Connecticut? Yeah. And so, you know, that's separate. But then Dr. Farha Abbasi, she's the person that started the conference through the psychiatry department at Michigan State. And she has her own story about mental health and being Muslim and being a woman and being an immigrant. And she was like, yep, we got to do a conference. And so there was synergy. And we started doing some projects together while I was a master's student. And now she's on my dissertation committee. So we kind of just all met. And, you know, what does it mean to find people who, you can almost read it on people's face, I mean, without, you know, making assumptions. But people, like, you know, you can see when people are sincere, man, you can feel it. It just feels safer.
Absolutely.
It's sincerity. And I think that's something to trust. Right, you're not always going to get it right, but when you just feel safe in a room, it's probably because the people in the room are being sincere or authentic. They're not forcing you to talk or not talk. You can just be. And, you know, we really have that synergy. So Muslim mental health, yeah, from like 2010-ish or 11, I tell now, so I'm 16, I helped with, like, you know, brainstorming for the conference. When I first started, there weren't a lot of younger Muslims that were going into social work or family therapy or psychology. We had psychiatrists because, you know, you can be a doctor, right? But we didn't have some of the other things. And now, I felt like, you know, one of the things that I could do is be a resource and say, like, hey, like, I'm getting my degree. You should consider it. Or bringing in to the fold of the institute so that we can make other people can help out put on the conference or have volunteer roles with it who are, like, getting into school for social work at U of M or at Michigan State or at Wayne State or anything, you know. And now it's, like, a very... It's a very national endeavor. We have people come from Toronto, from California, all over to our last two conferences. I recently transitioned away from my role as the creative director of Muslim Mental Health because I'm, like I said in the beginning, like I'm sort of on this trajectory where I'm learning how to take care of myself, and that's work that I'm very proud of. And I want to become more minimalist. I want to focus on narratives. I want to focus on my new marriage. I got married in March. Yeah, thank you. That's, like, the number one mode of my catharsis these days because I'll get into that in a second later because it's a story. But Yeah, I moved away from it, but they're doing great work, and their next conference is going to be at MSU. The last couple of years has been in Dearborn. And the first narrative is the pain that we ever did. So I was a creative director, right? So I would really want to do two things. One is bring more youth into the conference and into helping and all that. And two, actually three things. Two is find different ways to do things instead of, like, just standard what everyone else is doing. And brainstorm. And so I would lead a lot of our board meetings on the phone and conference calls. And three was do creative non-academic sessions at the conference so that people could not just be talking conceptually about mental health and how to destigmatize it or how to create resources, but to, like, feel it too. And that's the kind of therapist I am too, like the therapist I had, right? Is that, all right, we've talked a lot about it. Let's do this thing.
What's the name of the conference? What's the name of the conference?
It's just a Muslim mental health conference, and there's been 8 of them. So I got involved probably around the time of, like, the third or fourth one.
Gotcha. Okay. I'm gonna look that up as well. I'd like to see more of what's going on. It's that I've been involved with in any way, shape, or form. So thank you.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, now and now we have... Go ahead.
That's okay. Go ahead. I was going to ask you about narratives of pain, too.
Oh, I was just going to say that, it's great because now we have a nationwide directory of Muslim mental health professionals, and which is really important for people in a community that, you know, you're challenging a stigma, you know, what it means to go to therapy and to see people that look like you. You know, it can be a buy-in, and that doesn't work for everyone. Like, I personally don't necessarily have to seek a Muslim therapist, but what does it mean to see a therapist of color or somebody who shares your faith? You don't have to explain to them your validity. There's this weird experience that even if somebody is well-intentioned, but you have to explain your culture to them while you're healing. It's another step. And so, it's a difference for everyone. So it's cool we have a directory.
Okay, that's awesome. Thank you. Can you tell me about narratives of pain? What's that about?
Yeah, absolutely. So in 2014, I stopped doing Tunnel because I was moving away from campus because I was done with my coursework for my PhD. And I moved back to Novi, lived with my mom for a bit, and then until I got married this last March, and I started working again. And there was this, like, gap in my heart. I was like, I want to do something creative. I want to do something theatrical. I want to do something. And before the 2015 Muslim Mental Health Conference, I was like, listen, I'm the creative director. Let's actually do something at the conference this time, right? Not just the logistical background, you brought people in type of stuff. Like, let's actually do something at the conference that will move people. And so I started, like, studying is weird, but I started studying, like, really old Saturday Night Live shows, like the 70s ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking about Moth Story, and I started thinking about AA, and I started thinking about myself and how expression and healing have never been separate for me.
Mm-hmm.
The direction can change. You can start with expression. It can end up healing. You can start with healing and use expressive means, you know, either way. Mm-hmm. So I sat with my friend Hamad, and we were at a coffee shop, and I said, hey, what if we tried doing something at the conference and we constructed it and what it would look like? And we were very thoughtful about, as a team, we were thoughtful about what are the things about this that are going to be public that we have to honor, we can't pretend that are not. What are the things about this we'd like to preserve as therapeutic? So basically what we did is we put on a showcase of people who are brave, just like Tunnel of Oppression, except for there's no script. Somebody gets up there and gets up on stage, and they tell the story in the way that they want. It could be music, poetry, speech, disclosure, testimony, anything. And we're not the first safe space to do something like that, but one of the things that makes us unique is we don't have dialogue, meaning that one of the things about therapy that we wanted to preserve in the public space was that when you are processing your thing, it's not hijacked or interrupted by anybody else. So our tagline and narratives is healing through the witnessing and telling the stories. And so the best way I can describe it to you is if you were to walk in the room, you would see that the audience is close to the stage. We've been in different locations, so been different every time, but if we can, we like to sort of hug the stage with the audience, meaning like if the storyteller looks left or right or forward, they see audience.
Mm-hmm.
And we put out a call to people to tell their stories, and I host the show, and I took my cues from a lot of those other things, but you know, the thing about SNL, right, that's a peculiar thing. The thing about SNL is that I'm not a huge fan of them these days, not that much, but what I really like that's been maintained in their structure is every time they have a musical guest, they always just say the person's name and that's it. They don't say, like, the person's background or their resume. It's just very intimate. It's like, ladies and gentlemen, and they say the person's name. And there are elements of that that I thought mattered, right? Here, so we have certain aesthetic qualities. When you walk into the room, somebody's playing ambient piano music. We have a house piano player named Amina Ali.
Mm-hmm.
She's South Asian and Muslim herself, and she just creates the sonic experience when people are walking in. We have tea, but not meals, because meals are distracting when people are telling the story, so we have refreshments. And we were just really intentional about that kind of stuff. How do you create an aesthetic, sonic, visual experience that feels safe? And what do I need to say as a host about how we are not allowed to shame tonight? We can't call people out. That's for another space, even if it's an important thing to do that. But tell your story the way you want. And then what happens is when you have four or six people that are before the show saying, yeah, I'll be brave, I'll tell my story, then there's people in the audience that are inspired to get up on that day. They're inspired on the spot, and they want to tell their story. Or they get inspired, but they're hesitant, and so they have to work through it, and maybe they'll come back, and they'll come at another narrative pain, and then they'll tell the story. And that's happened, and at this point, we've had six shows. We did two at the Dearborn Inn, bookended in March 2015 and March 2016. We did a show at the DIA in January. We did a show in Novi. We did a show at the Brillig Dry Bar in Ann Arbor when it was still around last year. And I don't know if you know about the Dry Bar. There's a woman in Ann Arbor, her name is Nick Sims. She's a wonderful, wonderful person. And she started a dry bar. And part of it was that you give a space to people who are recovering in the recovery community, because the social atmosphere can be a trigger. And so to say no, it doesn't have to be, we're going to have a really awesome social space where we don't have alcoholic drinks. And so people of different faith communities, those whole people who are in recovery, would frequent the dry bar, and we like said, hey, cool synergy, why don't we just do a narrative there? So we did one last October there. And then this last one we did 2 weeks ago at the Arab American National Museum on Michigan Avenue. That was our September 16th show. And so, yeah, there's a lot of pieces to it. But I sort of see it as like an outgrowth of something like Tunnel 2, because it's like you peel it back. When with Tunnel, every so often you'd be like, okay, this is somebody's story. This is actually their story. Maybe it's their story. There's a lot of passion in the way that they're doing it, right? But with Tunnel, there's no question. I mean, sorry, with Narratives, there's no question. It's like the person gets up because they have to share something. The other thing that makes Narratives unique, we really want to differentiate it from like an open mic night or a concert. Not because those things are less important, but because they're differently important. And so, yeah, so for us, we tell all the storytellers that the first audience member is you. You're there for yourself on stage. Other people are witness. So you're not entertaining anybody. You might happen to entertain people, because people might do their stories through song.
Sure.
But
that's not
it's not the purpose. It's pointed inward. And other people are witness to you being that brave, and that's the point of Narratives. And so we do everything in our power to embrace that, and, you know, we have certain rules. And we do a lot of some communal games as well. So wedged in between the storytelling, the personal storytelling, we have one game that's sort of a heavy game and one that's a light game. So one is we'll ask a question or prompt the audience, like something I never talk about is, or something that hurts me is. And sort of like popcorn, everybody fills in the blank in the audience.
Okay. I like that.
And then at the end of the night, we do something light, like something I love to talk about is, or something that gives me relief is, or something that heals me is. And in the middle of the show, we have a prompt at the beginning of the show that everybody submits note cards into. And since I was a competitive slam poet, the only time I perform at Narratives is I take everyone's note cards and I turn it into a communal poem, slam poem. I just take all the cards and I'm like, here's what we all wrote together. And I just do it.
Got it. Okay, tell you what, let me interrupt for a second. We're at about 54 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to kind of move to wrapping up this part of the interview. And I have a couple
sure.
of questions I want to ask you offline, but I don't think they need to be a part of the recording. So if I think about how you want to wrap up this part of your story, you know, you've got a really inspiring story. Yeah, you've been through some very, very difficult things. Oh, you're welcome. I mean it. The amount of effort, time you put into your own healing, your own catharsis, and the things that you've done to help other people around you are really inspiring. Is there anything else you want to share about before we wrap this piece up?
A lot of what I've done has been about being unapologetic and being unapologetic about the people you keep next to you. So to sit with that culture of safety and relief that we're trying to do in all this communal work and personal work, one layer of it is not being afraid of your boundaries and like who you let in and what things you need some distance from. And so I only work with people I feel safe with.
Okay.
And I trust that. One last thing I'd like to say about Tunnel is I didn't feel safe my last year because there was an entity at Michigan State that wanted us to not make it a tunnel, to not talk about disproportionate incarceration rates as one of the stories. They wanted us to shy away from anything uncomfortable, and it was terrible. They wanted to hijack it. And so what I did is, it was very patronizing. And that was around the time the Malala Yousafzai stories was really making the news, and as a South Asian person, I was kind of like, you know, she's awesome. You know what's not awesome is pretending that we don't drone strike that area and kill a lot of girls that identify the same way she does. And so it rubbed me the wrong way seeing her walk around with Diane Sawyer and all this stuff. So you're sitting at the table and you want to write an appropriate script for Tunnel of Oppression that reflects that story, and you want to center it, you want a South Asian person to recite it or write it, and somebody tells you, well, no one, that's going to make people uncomfortable, so can we not talk about that? And spreading that. Yeah, I'm missing the point. So the people that from Michigan State, and it wasn't the powers that be in Michigan State, although that's another whole story. There was an activities board there that I wanted to hijack it. So I learned, like, I thought I was being a rude person from, like, being like, no, you can't help. But no, it was about preservation. It's about people protecting people's stories. That's what it's about. You don't let people that are going to shame or pacify you or tone police you tell you what your hurt was like. Somebody, you have a stomach pit, you stomach ache, and somebody comes from the left and says, you don't really have a stomach ache. Like, you know what you feel. And so their opinion doesn't matter. So that's not rudeness. That's just being sort of being real and looking at yourself. And, I'll say that. And the last thing I'll say is that the final thing I'll say about my healing is that in the effort of keeping people safe next to me, it took a long time in my life to let myself be embraced by the type of woman my wife is. She's a kid. And when you walk around in your life and you think that everything is on you and you have to be perfect and you've screwed up if you're imperfect or you have made a mistake or you didn't do something perfectly, to make a statement to yourself that, you know what, here's a freeing experience and I'm going to embrace that. And if she hugs on me, I'm going to take it. And it's awesome. I think that the person that I married was also, obviously, you know, her uniquely I love as well. One of the great things about her is that she allows me to participate in this freedom. And growing up, I would not have even entertained the idea of marrying somebody that would let me do that, because I would think that I was getting away with murder or doing something wrong, or I'm not being responsible enough.